This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It is not likely that we are going to see a home run kind of first vaccine. We're not going to see something that's 98% effective.
There's Professor Salim Abdul Karim, an epidemiologist, warning that the first approved COVID-19 vaccine is unlikely to provide blanket coverage. Details coming up also. Vote counting is underway in Guinea to determine the new president. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Around the world, the race is on to find a vaccine against COVID-19. There are, however, people who, for a variety of reasons, are opposed to such inoculations. In South Africa, the country on the continent hit hardest by coronavirus, the anti-vaxxers are starting to spread doubt about a vaccine that isn't even available yet. Darren Taylor has more.
One of the first scientists to write about COVID-19, even before the infectious disease had a name, was Sweden's state epidemiologist, Dr. Anders Tegnell.
We should not expect the first vaccine to be a silver bullet. We're not talking about a world-class vaccine that's going to make it possible to eradicate this disease. That is highly unlikely. We're going to get something that's going to make it a little bit easier for us to live a little bit more normal life and make it easier for us to protect the elderly in our populations. And I think that's a good start.
Like Tegnell, Professor Salim Abdul Karim is an epidemiologist leading his country's response to the pandemic.
It is not likely that we are going to see a home run kind of first vaccine. We're not going to see something that's 98% effective. We're not going to see the kinds of highly effective vaccines we have for measles, for example. We're going to see a vaccine that's partially effective, 50, 60, maybe 70% if we're lucky.
Both South Africa's Karim and Tegnell expect the anti-vaxxer movement to try to take advantage of the fact that the vaccine will only be partially effective to persuade people not to take it.
It's actually very unfortunate that in South Africa there's quite a small but very vocal anti-vaxxer movement. And social media is a mechanism that they use to amplify their very small voice.
But, says Karim, it's a voice that could cost many lives. He explains that in the event of a vaccine that's only partially effective, extremely high proportions of populations will have to be inoculated. This is to reach a level of immunity in a population that would eventually dramatically slow the spread of COVID-19.
If a significant proportion of the population doesn't take vaccine, they push us down and they prevent us from getting to herd immunity. And herd immunity is key because we cannot economically recover in the midst of a raging epidemic.
Back in 2009, Tegnell also played a key role in Sweden's fight against the swine flu pandemic. When a vaccine against that disease became available, says Tegnell, anti-vaxxers lobbied for people not to take it because one of its possible side effects was the sleep disorder called narcolepsy.
I don't think really influenced the trust in the childhood vaccines because they have remained at the same level. But of course they are in the back of people's mind that that happened last time. And that's going to be a communication challenge for us to get people to understand that this is going to be a safe vaccine.
To limit the space for the anti-vaxxers to do harm, says Tegnell, it's imperative that the first available medicine arrives with as few strings attached as possible, as he puts it.
It's going to be a major communication effort. It's going to be a major effort of following up because if there are signs of any side effects, we need to catch them very early on and very quickly so we can switch to safer vaccines.
The World Health Organization expects widespread inoculation against COVID-19 to begin toward the middle of next year at the earliest. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Vote counting is underway in Guinea to determine who will be the West African nation's new president. Yesterday's election, which pitted incumbent President Alpha Conde against opposition leader Seliou Daline Diallo, was the culmination of months of political unrest over a controversial new constitution that allowed Conde to bypass the two-term limit for the presidency. Conde became Guinea's first democratically elected president in 2010, after decades as an opposition activist. The new constitution prompted mass protests and criticism by rights groups about democracy backsliding in the country. At least 50 people have been killed in the past year during protests against the new constitution. Conde faces 10 other contenders beside Diallo, a former prime minister who finished second to Conde in 2010 and 2015 elections. Diallo has warned about voter fraud and has said he will challenge any irregularities. The final results are not expected for several days. According to Save the Children, the world was making real progress towards ending child marriage until COVID-19 hit. The organization says adolescent pregnancies were falling too, especially among girls under age 15 until the pandemic. And it says government's inadequate response has severely damaged or threatened a generation of progress on girls' rights. Mavis Ochera in Ghana has more.
A new report by Save the Children says the pandemic's economic fallout will force 90 to 117 million more children into poverty, putting girls at greater risk of child marriage and adolescent pregnancies than any time in the past 30 years. Save the Children found that 500,000 more girls were at risk of child marriage by the end of 2020 and 2.5 million by 2025 due to the pandemic. Agnes Odhiambo is the Human Rights Watch Senior Researcher, Women's Rights Division, and is based in Nairobi, Kenya. She says her organization's research shows that there are increasing levels of child marriage across Africa, and the COVID-19 pandemic could erase gains made in ending child marriage and protecting the rights of girls. She says the pandemic has caused hardship for families, communities, and countries, as many people have lost their jobs or had their earnings reduced.
You have no instances where caregivers have died, leaving children without, you know, the care of their parents. So some people have either lost jobs or they have, you know, reduced earnings from their jobs. And if you look at, you know, the economies in terms of how the government is spending, some of the governments have redirected their funding to focus on responding to COVID-19. And so that, you know, poverty levels have increased with COVID-19.
Odhiambo says research done by Human Rights Watch and other organizations shows that poverty was a big contributory factor to child marriage. She says in a number of African countries, when parents can't afford school fees, usually girls, the first who are withdrawn from classroom. Odhiambo says when girls are made to drop out of school, they are likely to be forced into marriage, often because a man has impregnated them.
What we are seeing in many places in Africa is, you know, girls being forced into marriage because families really don't have the, you know, the money right now. But the other thing also is that girls are also exposed to sexual exploitation during periods of crisis and where you have high levels of poverty. So you have cases where girls are also struggling to meet some of their needs, like around menstrual hygiene.
She says governments need to act.
The next thing is coming up with a plan of, okay, this is a problem, how do we address it? Governments need to make sure that they have national strategies for combating child marriage, and in places where they have them and they are dormant or they are not being implemented to reactivate them.
Odhiambo says governments should set the minimum age of marriage at 18 with no exceptions. She says governments should support having all girls stay in school, including pregnant girls. She noted that in some countries, pregnant girls are barred from going back to school. which she called a violation of the rights of the girls. She says national COVID-19 response plans should make preventing child marriage and ensuring that girls, married or not, have access to sexual and reproductive health services, including contraceptives. She said when schools reopen fully after the pandemic, governments and educators should monitor the gender breakdown of children who return to class and reach out and re-engage all missing children. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Ghana.
Traditional village chiefs in Cameroon's restive western regions are for the first time creating armed militias for protection against separatists. Cameroon's government has been asking traditional rulers who fled the separatist conflict to return to their palaces and take part in December's regional elections. But as Moki Edward Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, most chiefs have been reluctant to return due to threats from the rebels.
Vinso people of Cameroon's northwest region shout and applaud in the town of Kumbu. They came out to listen to a plea from their elders and palace notables to give a memorable welcome to their traditional leader, Mbinglo, whenever he returns. Mbinglo fled the area 3 years ago after separatists abducted him 3 times and killed 2 of his children for unknown reasons. Among the nearly 1,000 people who came to listen to the notables was Dorothy Yekong, who says she is longing to see her fun or traditional ruler.
When the peacemakers said the phone will be coming back, we just felt some peace in Kumu, because when we were there without the phone, it was just as if to say the child is there surrounded by lions. So if he finally comes, we are sure that peace will reign in Kumu. He is the father of everybody in Kumu.
Yekong said she was pleading with separatists fighting to create an English-speaking state in Cameroon not to attack palaces and notables who are only there to promote African cultures and traditions. But shortly after the Nso elders and notables made a plea on people to welcome their village chiefs, separatist groups on social media warned against the chiefs returning. Donatus Kewa, who says he is a spokesperson for separatist fighters in the northwest region, says the chiefs act as informants for the military.
All the phones them in Ambazonia, where they all run, come to Yaoundé.
He says the village chiefs and their notables who escaped from the English-speaking regions to the French-speaking zones, especially Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, will be killed if they return. He says the chiefs received help in escaping from the Cameroon military, which he says is an enemy that all English speakers should fight against. John Ewoma Eko, traditional chief of the southwestern village of Bausa, says he is ready to face the separatists. He says he has armed a militia to protect his palace, notables, and all traditional artifacts.
I've put in place a strong vigilante group of more than 100 youths ready to stand and face the Amber guys. They came and bent down part of my own palace. They left the 2 girls and they stayed with them in the bushes for 2 weeks. They were raped. They tortured them. They came back with wounds all over their bodies. They came again. They seized goods from my villagers.
Deben Chofor, governor of the Northwest region, says militias created by chiefs should collaborate with government troops. He says no one should fear the separatists, whom he says are only intimidating chiefs and civilians.
The traditional rulers are committed, the municipal councillors are committed, Elections Cameroon is ready, the security service are securing the region to allow us, come 6th of December, organize those elections in a peaceful environment.
Chofo said they were giving fighters another opportunity to drop their weapons and be pardoned or to be crushed by the military. The separatist crisis that is in its fourth year has killed at least 3,000 people and displaced 550,000, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Kazungula Bridge over the Zambezi River is set for its official opening soon as part of a major infrastructure initiative aimed at boosting regional trade and cooperation. But competition for the Bet Bridge border post may cost Zimbabwe revenue. Harigando gives us more on the story.
Work began on the bridge 6 years ago at the intersection of the borders of Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The bridge is part of a broader infrastructure initiative that will ultimately connect the port of Durban in South Africa to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The 923-meter US$259.3 million bridge was financed in part by the African Development Bank and the governments of Zambia, Botswana, and Namibia. It is being touted as a Southern African Development Community economic integration success story and a vital cog in the regional infrastructure development master plan. Zimbabwe's Bay Bridge border post has been an exit port of choice from South Africa for SADC commercial cargo, particularly with stringent COVID-19 restrictions at Botswana's border posts. Economic analysts applaud the initiative to advance regional integration and intra-African trade. They concede Zimbabwe might lose revenue from traffic at the Bay Bridge crossing. Economic analyst Mahambo Hamaundu from Zambia weighs in.
You know, they might indeed suffer a bit of revenue loss in the interim because, of course, they'll not be able to collect the tolls because people will now have to use the other route which goes through a different border post into Botswana, through Kazungula into Zambia and going to Congo, going to Malawi.
Zimbabwean economist Prosper Chitambara says it's too early to compute the decline in those revenues, but there will be an impact in the long run.
Zimbabwe will certainly lose out on trade and investment opportunities as well as the associated revenues from that trade and investment, as well as also lots of transit fees and taxes that were being levied on goods that were also passing through Zimbabwe. Definitely there's going to be a significant loss.
But Hamaundu from Zambia sees a silver lining for Zimbabwe.
When you flip the coin, you could also see that because the Zimbabwean roads will not be carrying as much heavy traffic, their roads might last a little bit longer. But ultimately, the Bay Bridge will all of a sudden also appear to be attractive because it will be handling less traffic. The result will be that the people at the border will appear to be operating a bit more efficiently. Traffic will be distributed through two or three different points, and ultimately they too can actually seize this opportunity to try and can improve their road infrastructure.
Hamaundu says the bigger picture is what matters for the region, with more ports making the region attractive for investment. Motlodi Sebabole, chief economist at the First National Bank of Botswana, agrees that the bridge will be good for the region.
Particularly that this bridge also comes with one-stop border posts, which solves for a lot of issues when you go through one border entry at one side of the country and then move into another. That does take care of a lot of nuances that has got to do with delays in trade. It positions the country better for taking advantage of even the Africa Free Continental Trade, among others, simply because of the logistical connection and the distribution that I spoke of. Corridor as well, you can build in value chains there that can open up for SMEs and even the informal sector.
Meanwhile, Zimbabwe is trying to find ways to improve its investment climate, but it has yet to implement reforms that businesses want. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
With Zimbabwe's teachers and leading trade union demanding salaries in U.S. dollars, debate has reignited over whether the country should dump the local currency and go back to allowing foreign exchange from several countries. Kudzadai Musengi looks at the story from Bulawayo.
Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube recently said the current two-year economic blueprint, which ends at the end of the year, has been successful by stabilizing the economy, eliminating budget deficit, and creating a surplus. The government also says the foreign currency auction system introduced in June has stabilized the local currency and helped contain inflation. But the latest figures released by the Consumer Council of Zimbabwe show that the price of a food basket for an average family of six has increased by over 45% from last month. President of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, ZCTU, Peter Mtasa, says lack of public confidence in the local currency has fed inflation, which continues to erode incomes. He says it is imperative that government revert to the multiple currency regime, as the prices of most goods and services are now pegged in US dollars.
The government has no option. We must just officially dollarize. That's the only way to tame the twin evils of high inflation and also devaluation. Currently, government is under pressure to increase salaries. If it increases salaries in Zim dollar, it will create another challenge in terms of inflation. But it can pay living wages and decent salaries in US dollars without creating chronic inflation and also devaluation, as we witnessed in 2009.
But regional leader of the Affirmative Action Group and independent economic analyst Reginald Shoko disagrees that the economy is dollarizing, saying it would not be prudent for the country to formally do so.
We have enough US dollars in Zimbabwe, yes, but they are in the individual hands. So to then talk about dollarizing in that situation, it's not an easy thing, because we will then have an economy that will render or play to the terms of those that have, and it will be difficult for those who don't have. As it stands now, most companies are too earning a bit of foreign currency, but they are not transmitting those earnings even to the salaries of their workers.
In June last year, the country totally banned the use of foreign currency and reintroduced the Zimbabwean dollar, which had hitherto been substituted by the bond note, a surrogate currency. But as the parallel market continued to thrive and the Zim dollar plummeted, government reintroduced the dual system, whereby the local currency is used alongside multiple currencies, including the US dollar and the South African rand. Researcher Prosper Chitambara of the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe agrees that the local currency has generated little confidence. But he says there is need for broad-based consensus before the country can return to full dollarization.
Government has unveiled a dual pricing policy, which effectively is actually a re-dollarization. But we have not fully re-dollarized in the sense that most of our people are still earning salaries in Zim dollars, in particular the civil servants here. But I think it's a discussion that we need to have, but a discussion that should result in a consensus position, not a foisted position, so to speak.
A member of the ruling ZANU-PF party's central committee, Joseph Chuma, says there is no need to officially return to dollarization, as the dual system already is helping to stabilize the economy. The Zim dollar has remained steady against the US dollar on the foreign currency weekly auction system by the central bank that replaced the interbank market. Critics claim the value of the local currency is manipulated to give a false sense of value, since inflation continues to gallop due to COVID-19, drought and other factors. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.